Hey, this is Robin Miller, and you need more front wing and a little more vodka probably, too.
Hello and welcome to another More Front Wing podcast. I'm Steph Wallcraft, and my co-editor Paul Dalby is back.
Yay!
Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And glad you're here. It was getting a little too agreeable around here.
A little rusty, so whatever cohesion and agreement we had before, we'll just assume it's all gone and we'll start backwards.
So Paul and I have decided that because the event at Toronto was so very eventful, let's say, we're going to tackle this one on our own because we think we've got an awful lot to cover in a short amount of time. So let's get started by talking about the event itself and the atmosphere since I was at the event and I can report on that. It was, I'm going to be honest, Friday, I didn't feel that the crowd was any better than last year. Saturday was about an average Saturday road course crowd, nothing terrible, but not spectacular. And even Sunday morning for the lights race, I was feeling a little bit antsy. I should have known better because it always is that way at that time on a Sunday. But by the time the field was lined up in pit lane, it really actually looked quite awesome. The grandstands were packed. There was energy about the place. I can report that corporate support for the event was significantly up this year. There was an entire new set of corporate suites on the front straight for, I believe it was Ferrari, had purchased, I think, 3 or 4 boxes worth, and they had set that up on the far side of the front straight. And there was just a lot more promotion going on. For the past couple of years, part of the, let's call it the visitor midway, has been inside the big building that you can see from the front stretch called the Direct Energy Center. And part of it has been in the infield in the section that's for years has been called Thunder Alley. This year, they took all of the vendors out of the Direct Energy Center and dedicated that space just to support series paddocks, and they took all of the vendors and put them all in Thunder Alley in one place, and that was such an excellent move. I can't even begin to emphasize how good a move that was because it felt busier. It felt like there were more people there. It felt like there was a lot more going on. Honda Canada had an enormous display with all kinds of cars and race simulators and things like that. Music blaring. The fan village, the IndyCar fan village, was in the same spot. There were all sorts of different. I think the Canadian military had a display, all sorts of different booths to buy merchandise, lots of giveaways. Target had a huge display because Target is actually entering Canada for the first time in 2013, if I remember correctly. So they're doing a huge rollout for that, and they had people there giving away free reusable bags, and they had the giant carts, the carts that you can drive around. They had a couple of those there as well. So there was just a great energy about that part of the track for most of the weekend. Now, you may recall that our tweet up on Saturday afternoon was held at the booth for a place called Toronto Motorsports, which is a shop here in town that deals in racing memorabilia and that sort of thing. And I had a great conversation on Saturday with the owner of Toronto Motorsports, Derek Koska. And he had a couple of interesting points. He said, first of all, that he felt that the way that things were organized for the vendors wasn't the best, and that he was a little disappointed in the crowds, thought that maybe Green Savory wasn't doing as good of a job or putting as much effort into attracting on-the-ground fan as opposed to corporate support, that they put more energy into corporate support, and that's not great for people on his side of the business, which I thought was a good point. The other interesting point he made, which is sort of more of an aside, is that he was selling for two drivers this weekend. He was selling for Paul Tracy and for James Hinchcliffe. On Friday, he sold mostly Paul Tracy merchandise. On Saturday, towards the end, a little bit before, during, after qualifying, he said that he sold more James Hinchcliffe merchandise, which if you sit back and you look at that, you think, for the future of this event, that is a really, that's really, really good news, because it means that people are taking notice of James, and that he's garnering some attention, as he should be, because he's certainly a very entertaining driver both on and off the track. So good news there. As for the rest of the event, I think that despite the fact that things do seem to be improving, the event is up for renegotiation for the promoter at the end of this year. The overwhelming opinion that I keep hearing is that people are hoping that that Octane is the one that wins that bid. Should they submit a bid? They being the promoters of the F1 race in Montreal and taking over the race in Edmonton this year, people seem to think that the fact that they have more experience marketing in Canada would be a huge asset for this event, and that they might do a better job of generating some interest in the city and getting more people out and getting the momentum going a little bit faster than has been happening for the last couple of years. I'm sure Green Savory disagrees and is very interested in continuing with the event since things have been improving. So it'll be very interesting to follow that story and see how things go there. Anything that you want to ask about what happened there during the weekend, Paul, that I haven't covered?
I think the one thing that you started to touch on with the transition from Paul Tracy to James Hinchcliffe and how that changing of the guard needs to happen and appears like maybe it's starting to happen. One of the things we heard going into this season is how Paul Tracy's presence at all these events is critical for making, I mean, never mind his success, they you say the Toronto race will fail without him. What sort, did the race still have the same, or the fans still have that same support for Paul Tracy? Did it feel like if he wasn't there, that the event would not have had the support that it did have this weekend?
I would say for this year, yes. I would say if the rumor does come to pass, and this is another thing that I can share. I was at an event on the Thursday night before the race where I picked up some very interesting information, and then PT fans will be particularly interested to know that I heard some discussion of a productive meeting between Paul Tracy and his manager and the people at Honda Canada that may involve possibly a 75-25 chance of seeing him finish out his career with Honda, was the wording, and there was some talk of a retirement tour and some discussion that we might be hearing some announcements in September. So PT fans, keep your ears to the ground. In September, you may be hearing some very good news. Should that good news come to pass, I think that the one more year that would give this event to get a little bit more momentum under James would be exactly what is needed to make that transition smooth. And that's all counting out Alex. I mean, Alex is pretty key to this event as well, and there were plenty of his supporters around this weekend too. So, but I do feel that the change is possible, and it's not even necessarily in the long term. We're talking short term. I think this one more year of having all three of those drivers present in the field is all that would be needed. And James is going to be a rock star in this city in no time. He's already getting a lot of attention, and that's only going to continue to be the case.
Now, the level of support that Alex Tagliani has in the Toronto area, is it, where do you rank that in the three of those? Because I know being from Montreal area, or Quebec at least, they don't necessarily play nice with the rest of the province.
Well, yes and no. You don't feel that quite as much in Toronto as you do in some other parts of the country. I would say that from what I felt this year and what I've seen in the past, but more importantly what I felt this year, I think that PT is still on top. Alex, I would put kind of in the middle. I would still put James sort of – and at the bottom of the ladder, but I mean, he should be. This is only his first year. But I will say one thing. I saw more Canadian flags around this year. I saw more people attending with an interest in showing Canadian support. And, I mean, that's saying a lot because, I mean, you were there last year, Paul, and you know how big the support for the Canadians is already. So I was seeing more of that this year. But of those three, as you asked, I think PT is still at the top of the pecking order, but I think it's the time is coming when it doesn't have to stay that way.
Now, as for the, you mentioned the new seating, the new suites that they built along the front street. You had also mentioned over the weekend that they took my suggestion and
pat yourself on the back, Paul.
Well, I already hurt my shoulder, so it's too late. But they put some seating on the outside of Turn 3, which I think is a fantastic idea, especially with all the chaos we saw down there, that you just don't get to see, you know, really once the cars start to enter into Turn 3, that grandstand there, you can't really see them when they get into the turn. So most of that action that they had in Turn 3 was beyond what most of the people could actually see that were sitting down there.
I'm going to be honest with you, Paul. I'm not sure you can see that any better from that general admission hill that they opened up on the opposite side. They didn't put any new seats in there. They just built, they put up a bridge that could take you across to the opposite side of the track where there's a hill that you could sit on some grass and see the other side. But it wasn't any significantly closer to the turn in terms of being further west than the grandstand was. You couldn't see much further around the apex than you could from the grandstands from there, I don't think.
Hmm.
I didn't get a chance to go across because I hadn't even noticed, to be honest with you, that it was there until it came up when we were talking on Saturday, and it was Friday afternoon that I went over there to watch the session. I wish I had seen it earlier because I would have loved to get a better idea of what the vantage point was from there, but I didn't. So.
Now, did I also see maybe some seating on the inside closer back toward Turn 2? It looked like they had added some seating there, but maybe that was just something that the
kids... I think so. No, they did expand the general admission seating in Thunder Alley quite a bit along the back straight, but there hasn't been a grandstand in Turn 2 in years, I don't think. And that was one that was a really popular one back when they did build it, so that would be great to see that one back, but I don't think it's there yet.
Hmm. Other than that, I think I think it was a successful weekend. I think the crowds looked good on TV. I think they saw some pretty good action. Did you ever hear any sort of, you know, I'm sure a highly unofficial estimate for the weekend crowd numbers?
I didn't, and we won't. That's none of our business, as Press Dog likes to say, but it was up. I can say that with confidence.
Mm-hmm.
How far up, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess, and we certainly will never know. But there were at least... there was that one extra general admission seating area. There was at least one new grandstand that I know of. The Dr. Pepper grandstand was expanded. No, two new grandstands, excuse me. There was one in Turn 11, and there was one in Turn 9 that was added as well.
Hmm.
So there was quite a bit more seating, and it was all full, or close to full, from what I saw.
Well, trying to pin a number on a street event is almost next to impossible to do. So I never did take stock in any of those estimates anyway, just because there's no way you can ever really have a good feeling for what those numbers are. So I think going by the feel, and as you said, just the kind of general atmosphere is just as easy or just as accurate probably as trying to pin a number on how many were there, unless we actually had, you know, they actually told us what the gate attendance was. So.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I thought the atmosphere was pretty good last year, and I think if you think it was better this year than it was last year, then I think it's a successful year and another good step in the right direction.
I think it's safe to say this one is going to stay on the schedule, which was not safe to say back in 2009 when it was back on the schedule. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see Toronto going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah. Agreed. So let's talk about the specifics of the event. You wanted to touch on talking about the carnage and how you felt that it was embarrassing.
Well, I don't know that embarrassing. I think we've had this conversation several times. We had it on Twitter, I think, over the weekend. It's that you know, these cars now are just so identical that it's just impossible to make clean passes anymore. The ability for one car to just drive faster than another car and beat them into the corner just doesn't exist anymore.
No, it's all about
when you
get two drivers like Will Power and Dario Franchitti coming into the braking zone in three.
Right.
The difference is going to be inches.
Yeah.
It's whichever one of them has the balls, pardon my language, to brake later into the corner.
Right.
That's the only difference that it's going to be. And so, I mean, you're lucky if you're getting the wheels interlocked by the time they come around. And people keep saying, oh, they should widen the corner. You could have that as wide as a football field for all it matters. They're both trying to get the fastest line through the corner.
Right.
So it is a matter of them not leaving each other room. And it's not that the room isn't there. It's that they're just trying not to leave each other room if at all possible. And that was the case with all of the incidents in Turn 3. And it wasn't – there were some good passes down there. They didn't all end up in carnage.
No. In fact, one of the late race restarts, I couldn't even hazard a guess as to which one it was, but fairly late in there, it almost the entire field went through 2x2. There is room to get around down there and go through that corner making clean passes. The problem is they just aren't. Everyone knows if you shut the door just a little bit, that they're either not going to make the pass or they're going to have to back out. And the problem is that it's so difficult to pass because, as you said, the same Honda engine can only push the same Dallara chassis so fast. And it doesn't matter whether you're Will Power or you're James Jakes. All you've got is all you've got. And if that's all the car has and you've maxed it out, you know, it becomes a matter of aggression. And that's what you see when you know, look at any of those incidents down there, the late race one where Ryan Hunter Ray got into Graham Rahal. I mean, they were both just completely trimmed out. They're going as far as they can. And the only way Ryan Hunter Ray has any chance of making that pass is to force the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's led to a lot of at least that's what led to the ones in Turn 3. Then you had some other just dumb moves where Sato just completely ran over Danica. Likewise, when Conway just, he even admitted he just had a brain fart and just plowed right through Briscoe up in turn 8.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are other instances where you just have to wonder, what are these guys thinking? Are they thinking? You know, those are the ones that really don't make the drivers in the league look good. Now those are the clown car sort of incidents where you have two guys going hard into a corner and one is trying to outbrake the other. That's hard racing. Sometimes you don't make it. Sometimes you do. But it's the other ones where they're just completely their brain is just out in the field. Those are the ones that I think are more worthy of the. Of being penalized and getting, you know, some sort of reprimand than just the aggressive move.
Okay, well, let's take this and sort of segue into the penalties discussion then, because that's a very good point. Sato didn't get a penalty for his, pardon the expression, kamikaze move into Danica. Conway didn't. He did serve a penalty for his move. Elio plowed into the side of Tag. Didn't get any sort of penalty. And Marco at the end of the race, that wasn't even reviewed. I was given a list in the media center. I don't know how well this list got out, but it is in my post that I put up on Sunday, reviewing the events on Sunday. And there were six incidents that were reviewed. Three of them were assessed penalties. Two of those didn't actually serve a penalty because the car that was at fault was already in some way at a disadvantage. So Conway was the only one who actually went and did a stop and hold. But Sato was not one of the ones that was reviewed at all. Elio was not reviewed at all. And Marco was not reviewed at all. And that makes no sense to me. Mike, the conclusion that I sort of started to draw from this is that, and I also want to mention that I posted a lot of information from the notes from the driver's meeting on our Twitter account, More Front Wing, on Sunday. And one of the things that was in there was all the rules about the blocking. And the incidents that were looked at for blocking, for avoidable contact, appeared to be only the ones that fell under those blocking rules. And I don't know why that would be the case, but it seems to consistently be the case, and it's possible that race control needs to look outside that defined box and start looking at some of these other incidents for that avoidable contact penalty, because they certainly it was justified in quite a few cases.
Well, the other thing to notice is that if you look at the Briscoe and Kanaan incident, look at the Franchitti and Power incident, and you look at the Ray Hall Hunter Ray incident, where all three of those were looked at but not penalized,
mm-hmm.
all three of those are in Turn 3.
Mm-hmm.
And Turn 3 is the only, is by far the best passing zone on the entire circuit. So I agree with in all those cases that no penalty should be warranted, because if that's the only real super legitimate passing zone, you have Turn 8 and you have Turn 1, but Turn 3 is by far the best. You have to be aggressive to get passes done at Toronto, like we just covered, with these cars spec and being so identically matched. That Turn 3 is your best opportunity. You have to be aggressive to get them done there. If you start to penalize the passing zone when a pass doesn't work, you are just encouraging a very boring follow-the-leader parade. Now, I made the other argument a couple months ago at Barber, where you argued that Ryan Hunter-Reay kind of got screwed when he got penalized for hitting Ryan Briscoe down there, and said, that's an aggressive move. You shouldn't be penalizing just because they try an aggressive move and they don't fail. The difference is that turn at Barber is not a passing zone. I mean, that was a place where I think Hunter-Reay maybe made one other pass the entire race, and he was probably the only guy to make the pass. I mean, that's a very low percentage pass. It's like trying to pass at the hairpin in Long Beach. Turn 3 is the only place. You can't penalize the only really super legitimate passing place on the entire circuit.
Now, you say that, and one of the penalties that was looked at and considered to be a penalty but wasn't actually assessed because the driver was already at a disadvantage. One of those happened in Turn 3. I can't remember exactly which
one
was.
That was the one kind of where Tagliani almost, peeled his, scalped himself.
That's right. And that one was in Turn 3, and that was going to be a penalty.
They must have had a different replay than what I saw, because that one I guess I didn't agree with, because I don't remember seeing that a move there that really, I thought, justified the penalty. Now, maybe I just need to go back and look at the video again, but I was surprised by that one, so I can't. The one that I actually thought, maybe not deserving of a penalty, but certainly the one that I thought was the most unnecessary was probably the one between James Hinchcliffe and Paul Tracy. In turn, what is it, Turn 6?
I don't think that one was even looked at.
I don't think it was either, but I mean, I thought it was just a really dumb move on Paul Tracy's part. And it, for trying to force a move in a place that's a very, very low percentage pass, that was one where I think that, if they wanted to look at another one, I think that one would have been more worthy of a penalty than some of the other ones that they looked at.
Because that one just looked like really hard racing to me.
Yeah, but it was hard racing. I mean, it's not a place where you can really race too hard, though. Trying to make an outside pass, Tracy was already beat, and he continued to try to force the issue with an outside pass in Turn 5. You're not going to make that pass. I don't care if you're Michael Schumacher. You're not going to make that pass.
Yeah, I see both sides of that one. I'm one to sort of want to lean more heavily on the side of not penalizing too often. So I don't like the idea of doing anything that discourages the drivers from wanting to pass.
I don't think I necessarily think he should have been penalized, but I think that one was one that could have been looked at better than some of the ones that were looked at down in Turn 3. And
okay, that's a fair point. So I think we both agree that race control needs to expand what it's looking at. Is that what we're getting at?
Yeah, I think any time there's contact between two cars, it should be looked at.
Mm.
I mean, not necessarily penalized, but I think that they should give it the due process of at least looking at it
mm-hmm.
and reporting that they looked at it.
Yeah, well, and that's really the key, isn't it? It's all about openness in communication.
Absolutely.
And that, speaking of that and penalties, let's talk a little bit about the Dario situation, because it was a very different story at the track than it was watching the race at home, from what I understand. So apparently the fan experience at home was that the Versus broadcast said that Dario was going to receive a penalty, and then it was rescinded. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And the IndyCar Twitter account apparently at some point also tweeted that Dario was going to receive a penalty. And IMS Radio reported that Dario was going to receive a penalty. And a few of the teams told their drivers that that was going to be the case as well. Now, at the track, we heard, because the track feed is IMS Radio, so what we heard was what IMS Radio reported, which is that there was going to be a penalty and that it had been rescinded. But I, after that point, talked to a few people on Pit Lane who had been listening directly to the Race Control Directives channel. There was never, from that channel, any report that there was going to be a penalty in the first place. And I had heard that before I went back to the media center after the race. So when I got to the media center, I was approached by an IndyCar representative who said, "Hey, I just want to be clear with you, and we're telling everybody this. There was never a call in the first place. Here's what the calls were. Here's what the decisions were." And it was all very open and very straightforward. So I don't know where the disconnect was. It was somewhere between race control and television. But this one I really don't think was IndyCar's fault. So I don't think that they need to be put on the hook for that. As for the tweet from the IndyCar account, that's a little bit more of a gray area. See, the IndyCar account is run by one department, and is a different department that deals with communication between the media and race control. And for some reason, the person who runs the IndyCar account decided to pick the information up off the television feed, as opposed to double-checking on whether it had come directly from race control. Suffice to say, somebody's in trouble, and this is definitely a situation that's being looked at, is what we were told. So that is, from the on-the-ground perspective, that's what happened over there.
Well, I don't think we'll never know, but it would be nice to know where TV heard that the penalty had been issued for Dario.
Heard it somewhere, because I don't...
Somebody,
I mean,
had to hear it. Bob Jenkins did not just make that up.
No. I'd also be interested in knowing whether the teams that picked up on that information got that from television or got it from somewhere else.
Right.
Because Scott Dixon did definitely tell us in the post-race interviews that he was told by his team that there was going to be a penalty and that it had been pulled back, and Dario said that he wasn't. So, Lots of varying in communication there.
Yes. And this would be taken a step further, but if there had been a penalty issued against Dario and then it got rescinded, what kind of can of worms does that open up if that would have been the case?
Oh, that's where the questions of things like what PT or allegedly his hacker mentioned on his Twitter account about Randy Bernard being in cahoots with the Target executives and all that nonsense that we don't even want to think about. Well, we don't have to think about it because it didn't really happen. So,
well, I think it would. It just opens up the discussion: is there favoritism toward anyone? If this was EJ Bisso that made the move, and not Dario Franchitti, is there a penalty there? would Jimmy Vassar have been able to overrule that penalty? Is there an appeal process for that?
All good questions that I certainly don't have the answer to.
Yeah.
Good opportunity to talk about the situation with PT, though. You and I sort of started chatting about this before we sat down to record. So do you want to sort of flesh that situation out?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, and I haven't been able to follow it quite as closely as I wish, but the gist of it is that a tweet came from Paul Tracy's account, and I've even heard it wasn't Twitter, it may have actually come on track form. One way or the other, a statement attributed to Paul Tracy came out and basically said that Daria was issued the penalty, and then Randy Bernard called in a favor to get the penalty reversed because he was sitting with the Target business officials, the CEO of Target or the president of Target or some board members, a group of people from Target. And Randy Bernard did not take kindly to that comment and apparently threatened a heavy fine against Paul Tracy, at which time it came out that Paul Tracy said his Twitter account or Trackform account had been hacked, and that he didn't actually make these comments and that he didn't. Even though he felt there was some inconsistencies in race control, he didn't specifically say that, you know, basically Randy Bernard cooked the books, if you will.
It's like you said when we were talking about the Daria situation, there are three sides to every story, right?
That's right. There's yours, mine, and the truth is usually somewhere between.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess I want to look at this from two ways. Does it seem logical that somebody would hack into Paul Tracy's account and make these type of statements?
I wish I had seen it, because Paul has a very distinct writing style.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to pick out when what he's saying is true and it's truly him, and when it's not. So I wish that I had actually seen the comment myself, because that would speak a lot more to it, but...
Then the other one is, you know, Randy has said all along he does not want to check the emotions of the drivers, whether it's, speaking out against each other, speaking out against the league, and now all of a sudden somebody speaks out against him.
Yeah, but that's, if it's a baseless accusation like that, that's a different thing. If Paul Tracy was saying that he was frustrated with some way that Randy Bernard was doing business, or some decision that he made that he disagreed with, that would be one thing. But no, I think this is a completely different situation. No, I don't agree with that at all.
Okay. I think it's open for discussion. I agree. I don't think Paul or this. It's not good to make baseless accusations. I don't know if the guys from Target were there or not. I can't say whether they're baseless or not. Either way, I would agree. Robin Miller aside, you can't just make these just wild accusations that are, just outright slanderous, really. If,
mm-hmm.
There has to be a certain level of decorum to the discussion. I mean, it can be heated, it can be pointed, but it doesn't need to be personal. It certainly doesn't need to call into to question the personal integrity of the officials of the race. I can see where Randy's coming from. But I think the way the quote was attributed to Randy, it made it kind of sound like, well, hey, I'm off limits. You can't talk about me. And I don't think it was meant to be that way at all.
No.
I think the way it got attributed to him kind of made it sound that way. I think Randy would be the type of person that would foster discussion and not necessarily make himself untouchable, but at that level of personal attack, I can see where he's coming. And I think Randy probably would have made that same call if they would have if he would have pointed this at Brian Barnhart or another IndyCar official, not necessarily even at himself.
I agree. Randy's pretty good about making sure that he goes down with the ship and defends his personnel. So I think that that would be the case. So here leads into another question. Did you think that any of the drivers were out of line with any of the comments that and frustration that came out after this weekend?
No. I think it was out of line or not. It was great because it was real.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly, I felt the same way.
It doesn't matter if it's unfiltered or false. Even if it's completely blown out of proportion and false, it's real and it's in the moment. It's not, the interview with Will Power, I would listen to that 10 times again before I listened to one more of his Victory Lane speeches where, it's fake. I mean, it's choreographed emotion in Victory Lane. Wait until the camera's on, then you can get out of your car, then turn this way and raise your arms and yell and do this and that, and then we'll throw confetti on you. It's just fake and contrived and choreographed. These were all real, and that was what was so great. You never hear Will Power that upset. You never hear Scott Dixon that upset as they were in the post-race interviews, and that's what I love. If these guys would have been doing that for the last 10 years, nobody would say they didn't have personalities.
Mm-hmm. My issue with it is the fact that for the last, I don't want to say 10 years, but however many years, these things haven't been allowed to happen because the PR reps and the teams have been afraid that the sponsors would not be happy with it or that the league would not be happy with it. And so they've been generating these completely bleak personalities that toe the corporate line and don't say anything else. And I think I'm making suppositions here, but I'm pretty sure what happened was that Randy walked into this situation and went, oh, holy cow, these guys look dry. We have to inject some life and some personality into these people and bring the fans into the experience and let them have some glimpse into what these drivers are going through when they're operating their race cars. From what I understand, he and the league told the drivers that they should be that they were to allowed to do this and they shouldn't fear any repercussions. And it seems to me like the field is starting to get more comfortable with it and that it's paying off. And I sincerely hope that the PR reps and the sponsors can see the benefit of what's happening and allow it to continue. And I said on Sunday, and I'll say it again, I hope that everybody goes out and signs up for a Verizon product now to support the fact that Will Power is now being allowed to speak his mind and to allow that to continue, that culture to carry on, because I think it's so important to the growth of the sport.
Right. I mean, these drivers have had the personality all along. I'll never forget one of the first races I covered at Homestead a couple of years ago. Scott Dixon and Robin Miller were talking off camera, and, I mean, Scott just opened up. He was hysterically funny. He was just kind of off color, if you will, and just kind of really let out. And all of a sudden, they turn the camera on, and it's, oh, the target guys gave me great pit stops today and disappointed we didn't win the championship. Sometimes things just don't work out, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to scream as I stood there and watched. I said, why? Why are you doing this? Why are you turning yourself off when the camera turns on?
Mm-hmm. And because he feared for his job.
Exactly. And now it is so great to see them. I mean, you would never, 3 years ago, have seen... you never would have seen Dixon. There you go. You never would have seen Scott Dixon come into a post-race press conference and say some guy's being a pain in the ass, much less the one who's supposed to be his teammate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would never see that. And so with these shackles taken off, it's just so good to see them. And hopefully the media and the mainstream media that can push this out there really start to show some of these rivalries.
Mm-hmm.
And promote these rivalries. I mean, we've said all along this year, going all the way back to St. Pete, that there has been this rivalry between Will Power and both of the Ganassi guys. And if it wasn't blown up before, it's certainly full-blown now. With, you know, Will Power coming out and calling Daria straight up a dirty driver.
Yep. And a princess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty fun. So let's talk about the double file restarts. You first tell me what you saw at home, and then I'll tell you what I saw at the track, because these things don't seem to line up.
Well, basically, nobody even knew there was a parade or the pace lap until about turn 10, and then about the first two rows got lined up, and then there was nothing else beside that. Once again, they tried to wait until the very, very, very last second to line up the field, and they never even get close. Never. Now, some of the restarts were just absolutely terrible. Some of the later ones looked better. I don't know what the crap was between Dixon or Dario and Graham Rahal, why they took three laps to try to get it figured out, other than the fact that maybe Graham needed a little more fuel and needed a few more yellow flag laps to make it to the end.
I really don't think that was it, because we all know that you cannot count on Brian Barnhart to throw a restart. I don't think that was in at all. Dario said in the post-race press conference that when they got toward the end of the race, the marbles were so bad off, just very slightly off the line, that they were trying to sweep them and they weren't coming up. So they were trying to line up, and it wasn't working because they couldn't keep the car in a straight line. So that's what happened toward the end of the race. But I'll tell you, it was toward the beginning of the race, after going through the driver's meeting notes. Those restarts may not have looked good on TV, but they were doing exactly what they were told to do, because they were told that the I think it may have been different from this on the start, but for the restarts, they were told that the green flag call was going to come shortly after the leaders had left turn 11, and when you drop the green flag and allow racing to start when the green flag call comes, which was the case, you've only got time to get about three rows lined up double file before people start racing. At Toronto, turn 9-10 complex, there is not room in there to start lining up two by two. You have to do it after turn 10 and take it into 11 and then come around. But by the time you get out of 10, there's not that much space between 10 and 11, so you're maybe just starting to get up beside the guy next to you when you get to 11, and then 11 is a blind corner. So you've got to be paying attention to what's going on beside you and in front of you as you come around 11, and it's very shortly after you get past 11 that the green flag call comes. Now, that's exactly what they were told to do in the driver's meeting, and that's exactly how to play it out, and what they were told to do is what happened. People are going to want to crucify Brian Barnhart for this, but I'll tell you, I can promise you that that whole process took place with the agreement and the blessing of the drivers. So they're just as much to blame if you want to blame people. For this point, I want to submit that I think that throwing the green flag and allowing green flag racing at any point other than the start finish line is too confusing for fans watching at home. I don't think it's a good idea to do it at an earlier point than that. I understand why they're doing it, but I think they need to find a way to make it work where green flag racing starts at the start-finish line and not earlier, because people get too upset when it's done otherwise.
You mean like at Mid-Ohio?
Mid-Ohio is going to be fun. Yeah, I don't know how that's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
I think my problem with Toronto is we saw the same thing we saw at St. Pete, though, where they line up so late that they never even get close, and then you get this big accordion effect.
But Toronto, they didn't have a choice. They couldn't line up any earlier. They physically couldn't. So what do you want to do about it?
I don't know. I don't see why they can't line up a little earlier.
How? Where?
They could have gotten lined up earlier. I mean,
how? Explain it to me.
You could start lining them up coming toward turn 8.
No, you couldn't. And do you have any idea how dirty the
for the start of the race, you certainly could.
I don't think, no. Turn 8 is a 90-degree corner. It'd be a total mess to try to get them to go double file through there. And 9-10 is not much better, and it's a quick succession of corners, 9-10. No, there's not a chance. When you coming out of 10 is your first opportunity, and that from coming through 10 up to 11, which again is a blind corner, and onto the front straight, that all happens so quickly. There's no space. I don't know what people want. Maybe what IndyCar needs to do is go back to single files on the road and street courses and stick with double file on the ovals, as was the original plan, because I don't think that anybody seems to be... I think it's improving the racing, but nobody seems to be happy with the way that things are playing out.
What have they done for the last 25 years at Toronto? They haven't all been crappy starts like this. Have they?
What do you mean?
I mean, have all of the starts looked like single file starts at Toronto?
No, but most of the starts have started green flag racing at the start finish line, not shortly after coming out of 11.
So you're saying they didn't allow them to accelerate until?
I'm saying that they line up until they're told that it's green, which is far earlier than the fans at home think that it's going to be, based on the logic of it being at the start-finish line, which it isn't. So only about three rows are actually lined up by the time they call green, and then they start racing. So why would they go double file after that point?
Gotcha. All right. Yeah, I don't agree they should throw the green that early, then, particularly on the start.
No, I find it... I don't know that was the case on the start. They may have made them wait for the start-finish line on the start. I don't have my notes with me to double check on that, but definitely on the restarts, that's what the mandate was. So blame that if you're going to blame anything. And I do think that it's really confusing to fans at home, and they should find a way to have the racing start at the start finish line.
Hopefully Edmonton will look a little better.
It should. There's a heck of a lot more space.
They can't get lined up on a runway. They can't get lined up.
I think it's a very long... That's the longest straightaway on the circuit, if I remember correctly, up to the start-finish line there. So that should look significantly better, and then we can go back to the nonsense in Mid-Ohio. Should we touch on the championship situation?
Is it over?
I don't think we can say it's over. It's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a big challenge. He's a full race behind now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Dario may have been posturing, but Dario himself said all it takes is one DNF for him and a win for Will, and it's back the other way. But
that is true. I mean, you could gain 40, 30 points really easily in one weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But
no, I don't think
Dario hasn't missed a lap yet this year either, so it's going to...
He's incredibly, incredibly tough, and I think that's more the point that people are missing, is that, yes, he's far and away, he's way out ahead now, but he's just so darn good. He's got to be one of the best drivers of our generation.
Oh.
And I think he's underappreciated for that fact. And people just see that it's boring that he wins championship after championship and race after race, but we're watching one of the greatest drivers of our time right now. We really need to have some appreciation for that.
Yeah, I would agree. It's hard to say, and I made this claim last year after he won his championship, that he is one of the best drivers of our generation. I think, for whatever reason, the fans just haven't warmed up to him, and that's probably why he doesn't get the respect he deserves.
In fact, he seems to, now that drivers are all kind of coming out of their shells, he seems to be wearing the black hat a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. People calling him a complainer, and I'm hearing more and more people say that they're not too keen on him. So.
Well, I don't think he did any favors after Texas.
No.
I don't think he did many favors, certainly not with Will Power this past weekend. It is odd to hear some of these sort of comments come out.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another question that just popped into my mind that I'm going to get your response to.
Okay.
We have seen and heard so many times about how Will Power has just been so dominant. One thing I have noticed, and it doesn't seem to matter really if it's a road course or an oval, when Will Power is in front, he is untouchable. When Will Power gets shuffled back into the field, very rarely have I ever seen him be able to recover and put himself back to the front of the field. Have you noticed that?
I can't say that I have.
It's like he sets his car up always to be a leading car that doesn't have to deal with traffic very often, that is used to clean air, and that's very difficult to pass. Now when he gets shuffled back, whether it's by a bad pit stop, whether it's by just happened to get, like he did this past weekend, got caught out by the when the yellow flag came out, and got put back, where was he, about 10th maybe, somewhere, 7th, 10th, somewhere in, he was just kind of stagnant after that. And we've seen it at Indianapolis, we've seen it at several oval races, we've seen it at a couple road courses. He is blindingly fast when he's out front, but I haven't been able to see him recover from a situation, and certainly not very often recover from a situation, and bring him back to the front of the field when he gets kind of mired in the back. And I think, and I kind of started on this topic with you a few days ago when we were talking, but I think that is what's going to keep him from winning the championship this year. I think until he is able to come from the back of the pack or come from within the pack to get to the front, I don't think he's going to be able to win on all types of races consistently when things don't go his way through the entire race.
That in combination with the fact that his pit crew keeps putting him to the back.
That as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very solid point for why Will may find himself on the outside looking in yet again.
It's just something to consider. And next time when you're thinking about when you're watching a race and something happens to Power where he ends up back, you know he can come from third or fourth, but when he needs to come from 10th or 12th, he's never able to really pull himself all the way back up. It's a trend that I've noticed recently, and the more I've thought about it, the more I've thought of other times that it's happened, and just surprisingly, he hasn't been able to do that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something to keep an eye on. It's an interesting point. Anything else from Toronto we should touch on before we finish up?
I don't have too much else. I think we've covered most of the carnage.
Yeah, I think so too. So let's wrap up there, and we will be back next week to preview the new track at Edmonton. Definitely looking forward to seeing how things end up out there. Exciting weekend, Edmonton. We've got the IndyCar race and two Indy Lights races, as well as some support series races happening out there as well. On the new track, should be completely new setup actually, because they're running on the opposite runway on the airport from the one that they've been on for the past few years. So the paddock will be in a different place, and there are a lot of events going on in Edmonton this year leading up to the race weekend as well that people in Edmonton are very excited about. So I'm going to have to get my buddy Mike Cockrell on here to tell you a little bit about what's going on in Edmonton and sort of give us a picture of what's happening in the city. So we'll see if we can track Mike down and get him to give us an update. Other than that, the other thing we should mention to you is that we have a contest going on right now in conjunction with Jensen Motorsports. They are looking to give away two pit passes for the Edmonton Indy to anybody who will follow Jensen_Racing on Twitter, which is their new Twitter account, and just to tweet to let your friends know that you've done so. And if you do that, then you're automatically entered to win two pit passes. The draw will take place this Friday shortly after noon and will be announced through the Jensen Racing and the More Front Wing Twitter accounts at that time. So go ahead and follow Jensen Racing and let your friends know that you have. And good luck. We hope that you win two free pit passes and the opportunity to meet David Estella and the Jensen Motorsport crew. So with that, I think we'll call it a day. So thank you for listening, and we will speak to you about Edmonton next week. And remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more covering the IZOD IndyCar Series and beyond.